performance, never mind it was her telling of the most horrific moment of her life, that he was almost swayed on Kavanaugh. So I don't know that this is ever about what it should be about for Donald Trump. It's always about the show.
I'm Dr. Michelle Mitchell.
I'm a professor at Princeton University.
I'm a professor of history at NYU.
I teach Latin American history.
The Civil War, Reconstruction.
International affairs.
Wall Street, taxes.
Student activism and social movements. To Donald Trump, you're a hell of a guy. Oh, shoot, I read that wrong. Cheers, President Trump, you're going to hell, guy.
This is the third year Trump's too craven to be roasted. Don, this is a safe space. No one at the dinner is a contractor that you haven't paid yet.
We need Trump to have a better grasp of civics. That's why I think we should tell him that it has a...
Here's a little lesson for you, Trump. The branch of Islam is pronounced Shia, not Shiite. Shiite is the situation you have gotten us all into.
Of all of Michael Cohen's clients, you are definitely one of them.
I'm really angry and frightened about the government's inaction on climate change. I don't have a joke here. I'm just really angry and really frightened.
Just because you took over the Department of Justice from Loretta Lynch does not mean you had to keep the Lynch part.
Trump is right. Immigrants can be dangerous. Had his mother not come from Scotland, the country would be much better off.
Thank you, President Trump, for making so much history and for bringing about the end of it.
So, a toast to Trump.
A man who came from everything but brings nothing.
Trump doesn't need a historian to roast him.
History will do that.
Thanks for the song this week from
Joe Basie, Barry, Lionel, Bart, Jackie, Gleason, Golden, Earring,
and thanks to
Sarah, Sanders, Rudy, Giuliani, Rod, Serling, Selena, Mayer, Kent, Davison, Ben, Cafferty, Dan, Egan, Marjorie, Palmiotti, Mike, McClintock,
Jimmy,
Kimmel, Stephen, Colbert, Seth, Myers,
the
Wicked Witch
of the West,
Nicole, Wallace, Kristen, Welker,
Michael,
Cohen, Johnny, Friendly, Terry, Naloy, Trevor, Noah, Casey, Hunt, Roberts, Gerald, Nadler, Matt, Miller.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Lennox Local in Lennox, Massachusetts. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
It's my privilege to introduce today's honoree, William Kennedy, who was the first person I met on the campus at the University of Albany on Labor Day weekend in 1981.
Yay.
He was working on a holiday weekend, which tells you what you need to know about how to become a great writer. I'll not recite the lengthy list of literary awards that Bill has received because we'd be here for a very long time. With Suzanne Lance, I co-edited and wrote the introduction into a retrospective book published last fall titled Bootlegger of the Soul, The Literary Legacy of William Kennedy. He was born in 1928 and grew up in a working-class Irish enclave of the North End, in a modest apartment that contained very few books. He became an award-winning reporter at the Albany Times Union without the benefit of a journalism degree. He was a journalist who wrote novels on the side. Kennedy eventually transitioned to full-time fiction writer and part-time adjunct instructor at UAlbany. He and his wife Dana, who's here, taught dance, ran a consignment shop, and they endured many years of financial strain. Personally, I'm extremely grateful that Bill took a portion of his MacArthur Genius Grant and created the New York State Writers Institute at UAlbany in 1983. I'm honored to serve as the third director in its 36-year history, we brought 2,000 of the world's greatest writers to Albany, earning us the reputation as one of the preeminent literary presenting organizations in America. Bill is also the greatest chronicler of Albany, in fact and fiction, in this old Dutch city's 4 centuries of history. Bill's art is that he uses his creative imagination to reconstitute into fiction the actual events he lived and experienced over his long life, what he learned from the countless assignments he covered for the Times Union, and the incalculable knowledge he gained from his tireless combing of the city's old newspapers, historical archives, and overlooked nooks and crannies of documented information. But don't simply take my word for it. Here's what Saul Bellow had to say. Quote, "There are no dead sentences in Kennedy's work. His language is vigorous, full of energy. He's just a pure writer. So please join me in welcoming this year's honoree in Albany's own, the original bootlegger, Bill Kennedy."
Thank you, Paul, for that introduction. Finally, I started writing something about my family, and it seemed different, and it was about Albany. I had Morris Gerber's book, Old Albany, which was the first issue. It was all there was in those days. There was one edition of that. There's about 5 or 6, I think, ultimately. And it was wonderful. It was a magical mystery tour for me, and going back in time with each individual photograph to see what the city looked like in 1850 or 1898 or 1932, and then trying to place it like with the buildings. This trolley car, I think that must be in a parade of some sort. It's like a float rather than an actual trolley, and it's like a memory of the trolley days, but there was no such bus line or trolley line called North Albany. But anyway, I knew there was something missing in my brain, and it was the history of Albany. I was trying to place all these characters in a novel something like 1890 through 1950, and each one would move the family forward, when I came to the Times Union, I used to work here in the 50s, and then I came back in 63, and Gene Robb, one of the first assignments I got was to write a history of the neighborhoods of Albany. And Walter started going out and interviewing everybody I could who was over 90. Because I was well aware of the obituary pages and old folks dying with all that knowledge vanishing. And so I circled the city and went to every neighborhood and every ethnic group that I thought was, you know, eminent in the history of the city, and I put together, 26 article series, and I just discovered this town, and in the course of, I spent hours in the library, and it was such a revelation, the history of this city. It's so well documented, and such enormous variety of kinds of history that we have here it's endless, and the political papers of all the governors and the mayors and everything, and the political machine, and Paul chronicles Erastus as one of the characters in the machine, and I wrote about him as well in O Albany, and again in a novel, but it was endless. As subject matter, I never had to go out in the world. Like Hemingway always wanted to go to war, and Graham Greene was traveling the world to find a new subject to write about. And but I was learning from Faulkner, who never left home, Mississippi, and became a chronicler of the whole South through a single individual town. And that's the way I felt I would work. And that's what I have been doing. And today I began to focus on, what am I going to say down there today? And everything was focused on what I heard today from various people who were talking. It was about the idea of a story. And that's what happened to me. I began to see Albany as a story. And and that's the way I began to tell it. Back in 1964, the second year I was here after my return, I found a note about a year ago that I wrote back in 64. And I had seen it through the years, but I'd really forgotten exactly what I wanted to go back in time and start with the Patroon, start with Killian Van Rensselaer, start with the Mohican Indians, and come forward into the Dutch, into the English, and then on forward into all the ethnic arrivals, the Irish, and the Germans, and the Poles, and then into the contemporary the Spaniards in the early part of the century, the Italians who came in such vast numbers that we had a consulate on Madison Avenue, and then the Burmese and the but I wasn't when I wrote 64, it was, we were still talking about of black migration from the South into Albany and Chicago and the northern cities. But that was one of the new changes of the motion of people. But it was always a story, and I wanted to put it all in one book, and it was ridiculous, and it was absurd. But that's what I thought I would do. And what I started to do was I wrote one book about, I started writing about the political machine, which was so dominant, so powerful for me, and my family was all involved in it. And I started to tell a story of that, and then I discovered the story of Jack Diamond, the gangster, who was at one point working with the political machine and was killed by the political machine. And it was it just took me over, the book, and I spent 6 years writing it. And God knows what I'd have spent writing the other 350 years that took me to 6 years to write about a guy who only lived to be 32. Anyway, the idea of the story never materialized. I went back in time. I found Billy Phelan's Greatest Game when I was doing some research on legs. And Billy Phelan led me into Ironweed, and then Ironweed led me into Very Old Bones, and so on. And I went back in time to the beginning of the middle of the 19th century to write Quinn's book, and I was doing a parallel story of two centuries following the same character who was living both in the 19th and the 20th century. And it was a good idea, but it ultimately got done by the French lieutenant's woman. I thought it was too much of a gimmick, and I gave up on it and just focused on the story of the 19th century. But ultimately now, when you look at my books, I mean, it is beginning to be a chronology if you take them apart piece by piece and put them in chronological order. There's some continuity about it. It's trying to tell what I set out to tell back in 1964. And it wasn't crazy. I mean, it was there. the idea is still viable, and I'm actually still working on it, and something like that. And I'm actually going back to the Mohicans. And, anyway, so I can go on and on and on and on, and I just think I should shut up. Thank you for this honor and being part of it.
We're so glad he came back from Albany and didn't stay down in Puerto Rico. William Kennedy.
The ever popular Stardust, Raymond Ricello and his orchestra.
Back in those days, the to get to the telephone company was, if you didn't go to college, you went to the telephone company. It was very well thought of and prestigious type of job.
Because that was the thing to be. My mother was a telephone operator, my aunt was a telephone operator, and I can't ever remember wanting to be anything but.
We interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars.
Every light on that board lit. Now, that board was, I would say, almost a half block long.
Our board lit up when they announced that the Martians were coming across the George Washington Bridge. And that's when the excitement started.
Some people said, did I have a chance to see them? What were they like? What did they look like?
I figured them little peoples. I don't mean foot tall, little peoples, green in color with a flowing hood.
Have you seen any Martians?
No. They're going over to New York. Tonight the sky is alive with their lights, just as if people were still living.
Because they were crying and screaming and wanting to know if there was a lot of gas, if there was a lot of destruction. Were there fires? Is there a lot of shooting? Are there bodies all around?
But people believed it. They really believed it that night. And I think of the ones who were begging us to get connections to their families, to their husbands, to mothers and fathers before the world came to an end, so they could just tell them they loved them.
At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill.
One man told me that people were jumping out of the windows and they were going to kill their families before the Martians could get them.
You see, it was not a case of answering a light and connecting them to somebody else. All they wanted was the operator.
I was just so concerned that I was going to be able to help all these people, and never a thought of getting out of there because my life was in danger. Because I believe part of it was with the old telephone company training, you were very dedicated to your job. You stayed there through thick or thin.
A bulletin has handed me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country.
And one lady, probably minutes or many minutes after the onset, said they're as far as Chicago now. And I thought, if they're traveling that fast, they're going to be in Missoula before I get off duty.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be.
Any man that could cause that kind of upheaval in a whole country from coast to coast has got to be great.
We were exhausted when it was over with, but I look back now, I wouldn't have missed it for anything.
This has been the December 88 edition of DSG Directions. In each edition, you'll hear Bob Kapner discuss our successes and share his views on other topics affecting Data Systems Group. DSG Directions will continue to inform you on people and events throughout AT&T.
I want to thank the Capital District Area Labor Federation for the support that they've raised. As Tracy mentioned, the dollars can go far for the food pantries in our area here at the Regional Food Bank. And also want to thank the letter carriers and the Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive. It was actually conceived right here in the Capital Region. This food drive provides tens of thousands of pounds of food right here for our local communities each year. And it's an essential food drive to help restock the food pantries at a time of year when people in the community are not necessarily thinking about hunger. So a lot of times there are many food drives in November during the holidays. We have lots of groups calling and saying, how can I help? But in the springtime, it's when the pantries are starting to gear up for summer. And in summer is when many families who have children out of school are then seeking assistance because their kids aren't getting the free breakfasts and lunches that they do during the school year. We actually see an increase in pantry visits among families in the summertime. So please come together this Saturday, put non-perishable food items in your mailbox for your letter carriers to bring for all of the pantries in your community.
So my name is Tracy Martin. I'm the Associate Director at the Regional Food Bank of Northeastern New York. And today we were thrilled to receive a check for close to $1,000 from the Capital District Area Labor Federation in honor of this coming weekend's Stamp Out Hunger Postal Food Drive. And the money will be used to support the 67 food pantries that are members of the Food Pantries for the Capital District, which is a partner of the food bank, to help those pantries access food and other supplies to help those in need in the community.
Now, you say that for every dollar donated to the food bank, you can serve four meals.
Correct.
You know, that just boggles the mind, quarter a meal. How does that work?
Well, the food bank is very fortunate to receive a lot of the food as donations. So the food itself is free. And then we also have inventory that we get from USDA, which is distributed to agencies free. And then we have a purchased food inventory where we do buy food because we're not always able to get everything that agencies need donated in enough quantities to serve the agencies that rely on us for food. So basically, because we're very good stewards of the funds, we work really hard to keep our expenses low. And we have successful fundraisers that underwrite our efforts. We're able to provide a lot of food to the agencies. And doing the math, it equates to four meals for every dollar that we spend.
Right. You sell it to the pantries at a very, very low cost. What is that?
And we don't say sell because we're not allowed to sell donated food. That's part of the reason donors give it to us. It's part of their, they get a tax benefit, a tax write-off. And none of that can be sold. In food banking, it's a concept that's called shared maintenance. And it's a shared maintenance contribution of 16 cents a pound. And the idea is agencies that receive food from us have a sort of skin in the game so that they're super responsible with what they're ordering because they have to have, giving up some of their funds to pay the handling fees for it. So let's say, for example, this was a real example that happened. We were offered through Feeding America, which is the National Food Bank Network, a load of salmon, which is super nutritious and fabulous if you like salmon or fish, but it was in Seattle. And we had to pay to have it shipped here because our trucks are not able to drive cross country, so it was almost $3,000 to pay the shipping. So we can't absorb that cost ourselves. We asked the agencies to contribute a share of the maintenance fee to get those nutritious foods in the door. Mm-hmm. Now, I must say that our shared maintenance contribution from agencies is an important part of our budget, but it makes up about 15% of our total operating budget. So we do have other sources of income. And I'm proud to say that our handling fee of 16 cents a pound is below what Feeding America says food banks can ask, which is 19 cents a pound. We haven't increased our fee since 2004. So for 15 years, it's remained the same, and we're able to do that because of the successful fundraisers that underwrite our other expenses and because of our organizations and especially our director's commitment to not passing on costs to agencies who are really struggling as it is to do what they're doing. And of all of the donated food that we distribute, which we could get 16 cents a pound for, about half of it goes out at no handling fee. Super perishable things like produce, milk. A code date you have to be super sensitive about, like, you know, if you have pasta in your shelf past the code date, it's still fine. But you don't want to, you know, risk people feeling like they're getting bad milk or something. Right. So those items are distributed at no shared maintenance.
So just to clarify, food donations go to the regional food bank, mm-hmm. and then the food bank then, for a shared maintenance fee, distributes that to the food pantries, who then, for the Capital District, who then coordinates all the deliveries to the various food pantries.
Right, that's part of our operation. I mean, the food pantries for the Capital District and its members are, that's one of our member agencies, and mm-hmm. all those 67 members are members of the food bank. We serve 1,000 different agencies from the Canadian border up north down to Rockland County in the south and the whole eastern part of the state and west as far as Delaware County and Otsego County. And the food pantries for the Capital District has a program called Food Express, where they will pick up those orders and deliver them to the food pantries.
Right, and it comes on big box trucks. It's not just a minivan. It's it's like a delivery to a grocery store.
Right.
So some people might say, you know, why have the middleman? But your capacity here at the food bank is astounding, how much food you can store here, way more than any individual could give to the food pantries.
Last year, through our, we have a facility here, which you're in, and then we have another one in Orange County down by Newburgh. So we have a warehouse down there to augment service. Together last year, we distributed 38 million pounds of food to those agencies. And not just food, it's non-food items too, because everyone needs bathroom tissue, soap, shampoo, toothpaste, laundry soap.
Right, pet food.
Right.
Bus cards, some pantries do
that. Yes, some do that. And then we also have a backpack program that helps kids on weekends, and we give them food, but also gift cards for milk and eggs at Stewart's. We operate a farm, too, out by Thatcher Park. In the world of hunger relief, there's more emphasis on healthy food and nutritious food, and something is better than nothing, but shouldn't we aim for higher quality stuff? So
it's the idea that not just everybody has a right to food security, but nutrition security, adequate nutrition.
Right. And so years ago, this woman named Pauline Williman, who owned this land, she was in her 80s and still farming, but then she was getting older and couldn't do it all. Anyway, mm-hmm. so she said to us, is there any way you guys could take over managing this farm? So she put it in this trust called the Patroon Land Trust. And as part of that, it has to be used for charitable purposes. So she said, could you guys manage it? And we were like, well, we don't know anything about farming. Sure. So the board, they had all these discussions with the board, and they decided it was such a good mission fit, and it would get us nutritious food, no shelf life, no traveling from California, lost in trucking and quality reduced. We'll do it. And so that was in 2006. We took that over. We've got year-round staff, which I'm proud about. We do hire one seasonal person just to augment. But having year-round staff means living wages, benefits. You know, it's just a more humane way to have farm workers, and they're guaranteed. Because that was another problem we had. Again, I'm way off topic. But if we only hired seasonal people, there's a good chance they got other jobs and couldn't come back in the next season. And then we lost all their knowledge and talent. You know, we've got to keep them on mm-hmm. year-round so we can maintain the steady staffing and give them a sense of security so they're not looking for work, you know, and needing work off-season. So that's, you know, a source of pride because it's the freshest produce you can get because it's like it was picked this morning and it's here today.
Well, the work that you do here at the food bank is so important between the grocery stores and the farm because that food would just be going in a landfill.
Right.
Instead, it's perfectly good going on somebody's table instead.
Right,
so
right.
Not only are you saving people from hunger, but you're saving resources. So I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me,
thank
Tracy.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Hi, I'm Sharon Dierstein. I'm Albany carrier. I've been carrying for 20 years. I have a wonderful group of people, my customers, that always are very generous every year, and the people are very special, and they want to give.
Hi, I'm Pete Malaragno. Represent the letter carriers out of the Troy, New York office.
The Letter Carriers Association?
National Association of Letter Carriers out of the Troy, New York office. This is the 27th annual Letter Carrier Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive. It's on this Saturday, May 11th, 2019. You'll receive cards in your mailbox, and if you could just fill up a bag, non-perishable food items, and that all the donations go to your local food pantries. Everything stays local. It doesn't leave your area. So if you live in Troy, give in Troy, it stays in Troy. Same thing with Albany, Schenectady, and the surrounding counties.
Hi, this is Debbie Mayer in Hudson, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 on your radio dial or streaming 24/7 at WGXC.org.
Saturday, May 11th, tune in the Dust Bowl Fairies, John B. Wooden and Lee Free, live from Hilo and Catskill on the radio at 90.7 FM, 8 p.m., Saturday, May 11th on the radio at WGXC.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Phoenix Grace of Del Mar, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Velo Domestique Bicycle Shop. Professional bicycle services at 437 Route 295 in Chatham. Information at www.velodomestique.com or 518-392-3010.
Like a fire hydrant, like a public drinking fountain, like a park bench, WGXC is always there for you, at your service. 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
Oh, could take a sleeping pill and sleep at will, and I'll have to go through what I go through. I guess I should take Prozac right and just smile all night at somebody new. Somebody not too bright, but sweet and kind, who would try to get you off my mind. I could leave this agony behind, which is just what I'd do if I wanted to, but I don't want to get over you. Cause I don't want to get over love. I could listen to my therapist, pretend you don't exist, and I'll have to dream of what I dream of. I could listen to all my friends and go out again and pretend it's enough. Or I could make a career of being blue. I could dress in black and read camo, smoke clove cigarettes and drink vermouth. Like I was 17, that would be a scream, but I don't want to get over you.
These sounds are different to the birds. Birds live in a different world of sound. For one thing, birds are surprisingly deaf. Their hearing is deficient in both bass and treble registers. Few songbirds can hear such low sounds as, for example, people talking. And far from being able to hear high sounds like dog whistles, the birds take second place in this, even to us. Within its limited range, the hearing of birds is very keen. In one respect, they excel us. We are relatively poor at hearing bursts of sound. Our ears cannot cope with as many as 10 impulses a second. Birds easily do twice as well, and most of them sing at that rate. For us, the sounds are blurred, and it becomes difficult to locate the source. The result is that we are just as deaf to birds as they are to us, though for a different reason. Whereas they scarcely hear us at all, save as a low mutter, the twitter we know as birdsong is sheer distortion. We can compensate for this by listening through a sound microscope.
Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Peter Brauch of Midland Park, New Jersey. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Here's Border Radio from the Blasters.